Before we get started with today's show, I want to talk about the Right Time Book Club. Make sure everybody's up on that. Every year we do the Right Time Book Club, normally in the summer. We moved it up this year, and the book is The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith, a look at the Chicago Bulls and their 1990-91 championship season. We have got five guests to join us over 5 weeks to talk about the book. The first episode is April 23rd. J.A. Adande will be our first guest. From there, we will have Vinny Goodwill of Yahoo Sports. After that, we'll have Joe Dumars of the Detroit Pistons, then B.J. Armstrong of the Chicago Bulls. We'll wrap it up with the author of the book, Sam Smith. Also, be sure to tune into The Last Dance, a behind-the-scenes look at the 1990 Chicago Bulls dynasty. The series begins this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN. That is April 19th. And listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast presented by State Farm and AT&T. It'll be available wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening. Wherever you get your podcast, rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's that time of week where we have a guest on and joining us now. Check him out at Slate.com. Also, he had a great podcast, the Slow Burn series on the Biggie and Tupac murders. You ought to check that out. It's still available. His name is, oh, my fault. I forgot. He was also one time the fastest 10-year-old in the world. Joel Anderson, what's going on, H-Town?
What's up, man? What's up, H-Town? You only get to be 10 once, so, I mean, of course I was one time the fastest 10-year-old in the country. I was 10 once.
Oh, that's all it is? How come you weren't the fastest 11-year-old in the country?
Well, because then when you're 11, you got to run against 12-year-olds. So it's quite as, yeah, right. So I kind of aged into a different bracket, you know what I'm saying? Things change. You know, people's bodies change that age, too.
So what happened when you was 12?
I was still good at basketball.
You know, if you guess, you one of these too. Was your birthday like right at the line?
Oh, my birthday is May 28th.
You're on the other side.
Yeah, I'm really young compared to everybody in my class. So if I'd come along at another time and my parents were the kind of people that didn't care about my education, they'd have been like, let's hold him back a year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. A reclass.
Yeah, right.
Reclass.
Reclass, yeah, yeah.
Now, you know, the thing with me is my birthday is August 26th.
Oh,
so
man.
I'm like the youngest in the class and then got skipped a grade.
Oh, man.
I had no chance at athletic success.
That's tough, man. They did you wrong on that, man.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't going. I mean, I wouldn't have made the league or nothing like that. But I do feel like under different circumstances, I may have been able to present more of an athletic legacy.
Right. Well, I mean, they didn't even give you a chance. Also, skipping grades, do kids even do that anymore? That's something that happened a lot when we were growing up. I haven't heard of that in a long time.
Yeah, I tell you this, on my situation though, they just really didn't have no choice. I'm looking back at it, it just wasn't an option. Cause what happened was we lived in Atlanta until right before I turned 7, and I went to what I call like homeschool at somebody else's house. Right. And they were just like, looking back on it, I don't know how they got books. Like, I don't know how in the world they made that whole situation look, but for them, it was like, oh, okay. So you know how to do this. Oh, you can do this. Okay. We can move you to something else. So I then moved to Texas and went is in public school and I done all that stuff already, right?
Mom,
I'll never forget though, my mama said she went in and she tried to talk to the teacher because they didn't want to move me up a grade. And she was just like, look, how about you just give him the work and I'll show him what he needs to know how to do at home, right? And the teacher was like, nah, ma'am, I teach second grade.
Wow.
And she was like, okay, well, I guess he going to third.
Wow, man. See, that's, you know, the only thing I think about, because I don't think it's bad for a kid educationally, but socially, because I had a cousin who skipped a grade like that. And I just remember that he always struggled. Like when he was in middle school, high school, you know, it just felt like he never like found his footing.
Took a little time.
Yeah,
took
that's
a little
what
time. I caught up, right? Like the key was like getting the confidence up to like what was going on around it. But no, I will say this. Sixth grade, it's a little tricky, man, because life's changing for everybody else.
Boy.
And life is not changing for me.
Yeah.
And then we moved the schedule back, and then I was back on the schedule because of when the birthday was. Anyway, it took a little time, but by the time college came around, I caught up.
Although still, you going to college at 17, man. Like, I just, that just seems rough.
16. Turn 17 after. But here's the thing, though. It ain't that rough. And the reason it's not that rough is nobody knows but you. And so you've been at the same pace and doing all the same stuff as everybody else anyway, right? If you can make it through middle school to get in the college part, that was not so bad.
Middle school is the jungle.
Middle school is the jungle of the world. Middle school kids are the worst people in the world.
Oh, they're terrible. They are terrible people. And they're merciless.
They're merciless. And I feel like they put adults in a very tricky place because they've grown enough to know what it is that they're doing. But the law says you not allowed to hit them.
Right.
Right. And that's at that age where they legitimately tempt you not to hit them like out of discipline. Like we're not talking about corporal punishment. I'm talking about a fight.
Right.
Like me and you. Let's go.
Right. Well, they're just so wild, disrespectful. They don't have any of the governors of the maturity to be like to have the capacity for empathy or,
yes,
you know, whatever. They just, everything is to 100. Everything feels so emotional and so alive and electric when you're in middle school. I had a decent time in middle school, but even then it was like not a lot of fun if you think about it.
And they operating on the principle that you can't box with them.
Yeah. Well, it changed in high school. I'd tell you that.
Yeah. Well, that's one thing. I always feel like it's a very interesting thing to chart with people, which is what age you were when you realized that somebody will fight you like you were a grown man. And that age is typically before 18.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Absolutely. That first time that somebody has made it clear to you is a new game brewing. Let me give you the rules. Get out of line and I'm going to give you the blues. I feel like I was like 15 or so when my brother made it clear to me that like, yo, new stakes.
Oh, really? Like, yeah, nah, we not doing this no more. Like you can step up and catch this.
Yeah. Yeah. The exact words were, you big enough for me to hit you now.
That is an important lesson that a lot of people need to learn. And I feel like, yes, a lot of people do not learn it or they don't learn it in time. But I feel like everybody needs to have that lesson. You know, some people don't love you. You know what I'm saying? And they just don't put their hands on you. That's what my mom would always say. Like, everybody don't love you like I do, you know?
Yeah.
And it's an important lesson to learn.
Like, what we need is like a ceremony, right? Like some rite of passage to let you know that you have graduated to a place where you can get your rock. You know what I'm saying? Like we need, yeah, to have something, some certificate, something. This is to notify you that thanks to your completion of the 10th grade, right, you can get your rock. Like when you get your learner's permit,
right,
they should tell you this at the same time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, man, and the thing is, social media makes it so much worse because you don't quite comprehend the stakes that there are people on the other side of the messages that are being sent in, you know, sent and received. And yes, so I think people just have really gotten in the habit of talking to people wild. And I'm just like, yo, at least when I was coming up, and I'm not pretending like I grew up in the 1940s or something, but like people got beat up all the time. You know, you might have to fight. You might have to go into the cafeteria that day. There might have to be a fight, you know?
Yes. So like, do they still fight?
Man, hell yeah. Man, I have a homeboy who's a principal of a high school. He used to be a vice principal out at Dulles High School.
Uh-huh.
And he told me about them fighting out there all the time. All the time.
He's like, they fighting at Dulles?
He was AP over at Willow Ridge too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And he said they fight all the time. And he said not only that, he's like, the girls were worse than the dudes. The girls were fighting all the time. All the time.
Yo, can we tell the best Willow Ridge story of all Willow Ridge stories? And you know the story that I'm talking about.
As soon as
like,
you said it.
Like, please understand. Yeah. Me and Joel grew up in different parts of town. We about the same age, right? You graduated in 96, right?
96, yeah.
Right. He graduated in 96. I graduated in 97, right? But like, we don't know each other from home. We didn't roll together from home. I don't even think we've ever talked about this, but all I had to say was the Willow Ridge story, and he immediately knew. And y'all got to understand, Willow Ridge is like an hour away from my house, so mm-hmm. it's just not even in my part of town. But mm-hmm. my freshman year of high school, Willow Ridge had the best basketball team in the state.
Shout out to Ansu Cisse.
Right? That answers Ansu Cisse, right? They eventually won the state championship. This is well before the TJ Ford, Danny Ewing, Ivan McFarland team, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they about to go to the state tournament, and one of their players, who I believe was their starting point guard, unfortunately was unable to make the trip to the tournament. And you may be wondering why he was not able to make the trip to the tournament. He was not able to make the trip to the tournament because he got caught in a girl's room. And you may be thinking, wow, like getting caught with a girl, is the punishment really that you can't play in the state tournament? No.
Right.
The punishment was getting shot.
Right. The person who beat it out the punishment was yes. not the UIL. You know what I'm saying?
It was not the state.
Yeah, the wasn't state. The state. Yeah. Make this
decision. Pops made this decision. And as I recall, Pops did not go to jail for even a moment.
This happened right down the street from me.
Really? That's right. You're from Mo City.
I'm from Mo City. I was zoned to Willow Ridge. You know what I'm saying? So it happened within my neighborhood, the shooting. And, yeah, man. And I didn't know the girl, but I knew of the girl he got shot over. I'm not going to say
stop,
anything.
Don't do that.
I'm not going to say it was worth, getting shot or not getting shot. What I'm just saying is that some judgment, I think he could have used some different sort of judgment.
Yeah, it's like, I felt like if you are from Texas, you recognize that the consequence for trespassing is getting shot.
Right.
Period. Like, right. Them's the rules. Mm-hmm. Trespassers get shot.
Right.
This was well within the realm of possibility. I don't care if he had just been in there playing Monopoly.
Right. It's so disrespectful, too. I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, why the parents alone, for real? And from what I understand, what I remember, it's not like he was shot in the bedroom. He was shot in the hallway.
Yes.
So it was like the conversation continued.
Well, that's the question. Right. The question is, was he running away? Did Pops approach with the pistol or mm-hmm. did Pops have to go get the pistol?
Right.
Like which way it went. But again, all foreseeable circumstances.
Right. And I think that the testament to Woodley Ribs is that they still won the state championship in spite of this. Without their starting point guard.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
I think that kind of gets lost in the story. I think that's a testament to Ansu.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. SEC Player of the Year, man. Who went to Ole Miss.
Yo, I've always wondered how that wound up happening.
That was one of the first times I was like, I don't understand. Like, you could go anywhere and you go to Ole Miss, and this is not the Ole Miss that we know today that has tried to push back on some of that iconography. This is the Ole Miss that was only a few years from having the Confederate flag flying. That was my most vivid memory of the university at that point.
No, that's all. I mean, what else is there to know? They wasn't good.
Right. Right. They weren't good at football or basketball.
No, that was the thing about it. This tell you a whole lot. The only thing they could do to finally get people to start waving that flag was be like, you know, that's why we sorry, right? Right. Or like you do understand we can't do this without them.
Right. Right. But it's not like that has been a compelling enough argument, even really. I mean, they still fight over that. You know, there is a contingent of fans, a contingent of alums that still, they need to be convinced.
Yes. Yes. This is what I'll say is an interesting, like if someone were to ask you the difference between like Alabama and Mississippi as states, because I think that people kind of look at all those deep southern states as basically being the same, right? Mm-hmm. Here's what the difference is. And Alabama didn't go so far on this, but still. If they had been waving that flag at Alabama and somebody had come and been like, yo, we can't be good at football if you do that, all them flags would get burned. All them flags would be on fire. There would be no more flags. Ole Miss is like, well, we just gonna have to see. Alabama looking at them like, yo, man, like, you're not going to win this one.
Right. Well, I mean, that is sort of the thing that Bear Bryant, at least, I mean, you know, if you believe the origin story, the Sam Bam Cunningham story, at least he realized, you know what, I'm not going to take losing. So I'm going to do whatever I have to do to turn this around. That's not what has happened at Ole Miss and the mother schools. You know what I'm saying? They're like, well, I mean, you know, we'll see how it turns out. You know, we still got players down here.
Well, here's the thing I'll give Bear Bryant, though. And I mean, this ain't necessarily the highest bar, but I do think that this is worth considering. Bear Bryant did not seem to be operating on that, okay, just give me one or two to say that we doing it program, right? Mm-hmm. When they told Bear Bryant, it's game on, he was like, okay. It's game on.
I'm
Ozzie Newsom. Come on down, right? Like, I'm trying to win these games, baby. These cats ain't done nothing to me. Nothing at all. Sylvester Crew, holla at your boy.
Right. Well, that is a very Al Davis approach to life. Winning is the only thing. You know what I'm saying?
Al Davis, the pioneer.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to do what it takes. I appreciate that. You know, to an extent, it shouldn't take that. There should be some, you know, some sort of humanity involved in these decisions. You know, you should understand and aspire to equality, but if you know not wanting to lose is enough to integrate, then fine. And if that's what it's got to be, then fine.
Well, what I do wonder about Brian, because I do think that the argument is fair, like this idea that I'm just not going, I can't just walk in here and do this all by myself, right? Like, who knows how it would have gone if Bryant had tried, like, unilaterally in 1966, been like, I'm bringing in a black dude.
Right.
And I think you need to have your politics and like your office politics in line to make sure the player would be protected, so forth and so on, right? Like, I try to be careful. I don't want to give the guys too much credit for being like some of those early integrators, because they were just doing it for the hell of it in some ways. But I also don't want to be too scornful of some of these guys. But what you should have done was, like, there's a whole power structure that was set up on the other side. That being said, Dean Smith walked in one day and decided, I'm going to integrate the Atlantic Coast Conference, and didn't ask anybody for permission. Just showed up with Charlie Scott, took him to a segregated restaurant on Sunday, took him to an all-white church, dare somebody to say something.
Man, that's unbelievable, man.
And his plan when he came to Chapel Hill was, soon as I can, I'm going to do this.
See? What do you think of Make a Darryl Royal then, given that? Because did you read that book, the Earl Campbell? It's a biography about Earl Campbell that was put up by the UT Press.
Oh, really, no, good. I still need to read it.
It's really, really good. And it talks about, I mean, first of all, UT is the reason, they were one of the first schools to make standardized tests part of the admission process.
Yes.
Which was to continue to keep, you know, from integrating in due time. But also, I mean, Darryl Royal was not, it's not like he was at the forefront. That's something that he's always sort of had to answer for. As a part of his career. And I'm just curious to know what you think about that.
I also think, though, that historically, part of why Royal has had to answer for it is a little bit of bad luck, in that the 1968 Texas team is the last all-white championship team, right? And so they're in that, those Texas-Arkansas games. And so they become like a face and fixture of it. My buddy, Matt Jones in Kentucky always makes this point that if in 1966, Kentucky had lost the national semifinal game and not wound up against Texas Western in the final, the way that people look at Kentucky might be different. Now, Adolph Rupp was his own situation, but who did Kentucky beat in that semifinal to play Texas Western? Duke.
Oh,
now,
wow.
You imagine how we would talk about Duke, given everything that happened like after the fact, right?
Yeah.
Imagine the way that we would talk about Duke if they happened to be that team at that time.
Oh, man.
Who won, right? And so with Royal, I mean, and I'm not as familiar with the Royal era as I should be, but I mean, if he had wanted to, could he just walk in and say, game change right now? I don't know if the answer to that is yes.
Right.
Like, I don't have a great answer. That being said, I don't know how excited he was in the first place about the idea of this changing.
Right. Well, I mean, he obviously, as you can see, UT, there were a lot of structural things preventing him from integrating in all due time, right? But I do think that it, to the extent that we talk about these guys as icons and legends and, you know,
right,
these are some of the most important people, then it helps if you're on the right side of
it. It does.
It really, really does.
Like, people need to understand that there's a lawsuit filed by Galloway Supreme Court to integrate the law school at the University of Texas. And the courts deemed basically they need to open the law school. Was it before or after the decision that that the state of Texas was like, well, how about this? How about we open a whole new black college and give it a law school?
Right.
And that's how Texas Southern was founded.
Thurgood Marshall Law School, yeah.
Yep, and that's how it was founded. Like, how about y'all don't want to go to y'all own law school? You really got to come to ours?
Yeah, I mean, which is just unbelievable. I mean, in fact, Kevin Cruz's White Flight is one of the best books that I've ever read. It's sort of in outlining the length to which white governments or power structures went at that time to keep their schools from being integrated. I did not realize that Georgia shut down its schools. They shut down public schools totally for a year just so they would not have to integrate, which is just mind-blowing to me.
There was the county of Virginia that did that same thing where they shut down the school. The crazy thing about Atlanta was, there was a stat in that book, and I can't remember what the year was, but what was the crazy percentage of Atlanta schools that had two or fewer white students, not two or fewer percent.
Right.
TWO or fewer.
Yeah, man.
I want to know who those two are.
I mean, seriously. I mean, you know, like White Mike, you know what I'm saying? White Kappa, yeah, right. You know what I'm saying?
Like, what's going on with your parents?
Right.
Like, do they not love you as much as the other ones did? Like what's going
attention.
On?
Yeah, right. They were like, they was more paying attention. Oh, I didn't know the rules, you know, the rules have changed. Yeah.
Now, let's we wound up just going all over the place because why not? It's Rona time. You are a former college football player. Let's just say that school told you that Rona break is over, but you were not ready for Rona break to be over. Not you as, you know, late 30s, early 40-year-old man. You as 19 or 20-year-old. How does this play?
So the dilemma here is that they're saying it's time to come back. Like, we want you to report back to campus. Practice about to get started.
Yes.
You have to go. I mean, I would not have wanted to go. If your means to be in school and to afford school is at stake here, then they have all the leverage, right? The hope is that you can convince enough of your teammates to be like, hey, are you doing that? Are you going back? That's a couple things. Like, yo, you see that message? Like, are you going back? Or what's up? Because, I mean, obviously the inclination would to be to not want to go back, but there's just too much. There's too much pressure. There's too much institutional pressure to just follow orders, you know? That's the thing. I think of when I play football, I have a hard time explaining this. Like, even to my wife, who doesn't, you know, she's like, you don't like anybody telling you what to do. How did you play football? And I was like, you want to please your coaches. You want to please the people within that building. Like, it is a big part. Because also, they in control of your playing time, how you move around the building, all these other things, you know. And you just want to make people happy, and you want to excel on the field. And so you're willing to do things that might not necessarily be good for your health. I had a concussion in practice my freshman year, missed the morning session and came back out for the afternoon session. Nobody told me I had to do that, but it was just like, well, I can't sit here. You know what I'm saying? I need to get out there and impress people. So me, 19, 20-year-old Joel, I was showed up on campus like they told me to.
I've been interested to see the people, like Herm Edwards said this, Gene Smith, the AD at Ohio State said it. We've seen a few other people make this very rational point, which is, if it ain't safe for the rest of the students to come back, how is it safe for us? Because there's 80-something dudes on scholarship, right? 85 dudes on scholarship on a college football team. How you going to explain to me how this is safe?
Oh, it's I mean, it's horrible, and it gives up the game so much, man.
Oh, yes, it does.
I mean, it's like, they can't even guarantee school's going to be happening. They can't even guarantee school's going to be happening. They want these boys back to play ball or to be in order. And yeah, if you can't, I mean, and also just imagine what group of people are less reliable to abide by the rules of a quarantine or a stay-at-home order than 18 to 21-year-old men.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. So, like, you can't cordon them off enough from public enough to ensure that they're not going to step outside and endanger themselves or put themselves at risk of getting exposed to COVID-19.
And now we're going to put them all around each other.
Right. Right. And, I mean, we've seen enough examples of young people dying to know that it is not a given that just because you get it that you're going to recover. There are some players that go home, and going home ain't necessarily any safer or better for some players than being on campus, right? You know, they get three squares. You know, they have, you know, their own living quarters for the most part. But, I mean, to get these guys together to play football, man, it just seems grossly irresponsible. These are the guys that come to your home when you're 17 years old and say they're going to take care of you. And they're going to look out for you as if they were their own son. And I have a hard time believing that they would be pushing their own children to be out there playing and risking themselves under these circumstances.
Yeah, that part is very interesting. Like, I wonder for this, because a lot of these coaches, they got their kids on the team, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'd be very curious to know how that affects the way that these dudes view the idea of coming back. Because, hey, man, there's another part of this, and this is just kind of uncomfortable. But whenever people would talk about the idea of paying players, mm-hmm. one of the frequent counter arguments is, well, then the non-revenue sports would go away. And I'm like, well, okay, that's the trade that we have to make, unfortunately, right? Somebody's got to lose. It's kind of a concept in economics called Pareto optimality. Like, we are at a point where we can't improve somebody's condition without unimproving somebody else's condition, right? Like, this is where we are. It's an unfortunate break. I get where you're coming from, but man, you're going to start seeing this. University of Cincinnati, I think they just dropped their soccer program.
Right.
And everybody's real sad about that. And I totally get it. But in the end, they're not going to be able to afford this stuff, man. Like, I understand why. I can't blame anybody for not looking for every way possible to try to get back out there. Just understand that there probably isn't one. But there's some bills that are going to come due, and there's some people that are not going to get their money, and there's some programs that are going to have to go away. Like, I'm an HBCU grad. I got a different fear. I fear my alma mater. Forget about a little program that we got out there. Like, I fear what's going to happen to the whole school and for a lot of these other schools. But a lot of these other, like, people is going to be real sad when it happens, but this is the game when you don't make money.
Well, they have created it in such a way, for one, that they don't have any extra money. They spend up all the money that they have. So they created this artificial economic reality for themselves, to which they're like, well, hey, we ain't got no money. Well, you created it. You wanted it this way. You're the one that had, you know, your football program has 5 offensive analysts.
Right.
That didn't used to exist 15 years ago. You didn't need that, but you decided you wanted it. I actually tend to believe that these athletic departments, at least the top P5 programs, right? Like, we're talking about Ohio State, Michigan, right, Texas, blah, blah, blah. They've got the money. But you, like you said, Cincinnati is like one of those schools, or like, I think of some place like University of Louisiana Monroe. They ain't got no money. For a lot of these places, not just the non-revenue sports, the revenue sports they might have to take a look at. Because, I mean, how can they continue to argue to fund this if they have money, if they have difficulty just funding the institution itself?
Right. Well, also, let me tell you something about those big schools that you talk about. Like, they're going to be fine. I do agree that, like, the probably the high end top 10, they're going to be okay. Mm-hmm. But college football in general has made a bad investment as it relates to the times that I don't think is talked about enough, which is a lot of these programs are carrying heavy debt loads off stadium renovations.
Oh, capital improvements. Yeah.
Right. Capital improvements, but specifically increasing the size of these stadiums. Ooh. And adding more of these bleachers at a time when people are actually attending games less and less. And that's where I think a lot of these programs are going to get stuck in this, is they've got to pay for these things that they've done for these stadiums. They got to pay for these luxury boxes that they've had built in order to bring in more of this ticket revenue, which, by the way, isn't even that big a piece of the pie when it comes to what their money actually is. But these stadiums are not going to pay for themselves. And I don't, and like, even if they talk about coming back, we're coming back without people.
Man, think about, I mean, I know, I mean, nobody's taking pleasure in anybody's difficulty, but I think about a school like Texas A&M. You mention them all the time because so much of their fortunes depend on, like, the price of oil. So they're going to be dealing with that, plus all the money they poured into the expansion of that program and the stadium. Like, what are they going to do, for instance? You know what I mean?
Right. I had forgotten that price of crude situation for A&M. Like, I ain't been paying attention to what's going on over there, but they are not. Like, A&M, basically, they program is Venezuela. I was just watching this documentary on Cuba. And, you know, it was like after the Soviets got out of there, you know, Venezuela did a lot for Cuba. One of the big things Venezuela was doing was giving them a bunch of oil. And so they give them a bunch of oil, they'd hold half, and they'd sell the other half. But then when oil price falls to like $8 a barrel.
Yeah.
Everything's a problem in Cuba, and it's a problem in Venezuela because they getting all their money off selling that oil.
Oh, yeah, man. See, what's the name of this documentary? You just watching a random?
Cuba Libre.
All right.
No, it's like an 8-episode docuseries. It's actually really interesting. It goes like back before the Spanish-American War and takes you into the 21st century, and kind of like a whole lot made a lot more sense to me after watching that. And it's also interesting because they took great care to try not to portray Fidel Castro as anything. Try not to make him a saint. Try not to make him the devil, right? They were just like, all we could do is lay this stuff out there. Like, it ain't a whole lot of Fidel saying a lot in there, because it's impossible to give anything close to a neutral portrayal of Fidel Castro. And you got two sides on Castro, and they each think the other side is ridiculous, right? And so they're not trying to hear anything in either way.
Right. Without getting political, I mean, I know that was a part of the political debate this year. And the idea that Fidel Castro could do anything good is absurd to some people, and they just don't want to hear it. And so, yeah, I mean, I could totally understand that if you have a documentary, you don't want people to get caught up on that, right? You don't want people to get caught up on that. Because otherwise, you just, everything slows down. You stop, you cease to listen to everything else.
But that being said, on the flip side, the people who like embrace Castro full on as revolutionary, when they show the clip of Fidel lighting somebody up against the wall and you see him blow somebody's brains out, then, it gets to be a little,
Wait, that's in the documentary?
It's in it.
Oh man. All right. I mean,
it's a very matter of fact portrayal.
Wow.
That is what I'll give you. It is a very matter of fact portrayal. But yes, I just made Texas A&M, Fidel Castro all came together in a way that people could never understand or appreciate on the front end. But now I'm worried, like, the college football thing is going to be bad. I don't know what's going to happen to all these, like, these pro teams. Cause we got to remember, man, not all these rich cats are as rich as you think.
I want Tillman to get the hell out of here, man. I'm tired of him, bro. For real, man. He's with his broke ass. You know what I'm saying?
The thing is, he's not even broke. His money is just in all the worst places right now.
What do you own? Restaurants.
And a basketball team.
Right.
Right. He ain't got no shares of Zoom.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Right. Right. He's not getting that money. He doesn't own a paper towel factory.
He's got a real 1980s, 90s ass, like, financial, you know, portfolio.
Yes.
Like the Maloof brothers. They seem like that was amazing to own casinos. Look at casinos. Never lose money with a casino, right? You know? Being in the tourism industry, that's perfect. That's what you're supposed to do. Man, ain't nobody going to the Kima boardwalk no more, man.
No. And Vertita, like, all of this for him is just, and you know what? Here's why I can't feel bad for none of them. Did you see that story in Texas Monthly about HEB?
Yes. How they were prepared.
Yes. Yes. So for people who don't know, HEB is a grocery store chain in Texas. It's based in San Antonio. If you're a League Pass watcher, you see the HEB commercials a lot with the different Spurs in them, right? Like, they're known for kind of having those quirky commercials with the Spurs in them. All right. So HEB, apparently, when the swine flu, I think, was hitting the streets, HEB saw what was going on because it was affecting some of their supply chain stuff in China. And they said from there, they were like, okay, we need to have a plan. Mm-hmm. And so when COVID-19 hit, HEB had a plan. They had masks and all that stuff ready for their staff. They had done like all the things. They knew everything that needed to be done, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact that they could tells me that everybody else had a chance to be ready. Even if they didn't know this particular thing was coming, they knew that something like this could happen and they would need to be insulated from it. Instead, all these businesses out here living check to check.
Right, man. And I mean, the thing is that for them, they have to be willing to put people's lives at risk, because otherwise the money doesn't come in no more. You know what I mean? And that's just the bottom line. And I've heard you talk about this, and I'm torn on whether or not we'll see sports again.
You mean like ever?
What, this in 2020?
Oh, 2020, I don't think it's going to happen.
Man, this is so much money at stake, man.
All it takes is one governor. So like, if Gavin Newsom says that there are no sports in California this year, then there are no sports in 2020. Like, what league can function without the role of the California entities?
Do you not think that there will be like an incredible amount of political pressure? Like, especially if we get to October and life is still like this, we flatten the curve such as it is. You don't think there will be tremendous political pressure on a guy like that to be like, all right, man, it's time to open it up. People are going crazy. People are broke. You know, people need to get back to work.
All right. I'll put it like this. Yes, there will be an incredible level of pressure. And you're right. There may be somebody that gives in to it. At which point there will be a breakout at one of these. And now we all going right back for God knows how long. You seen the story about, what was it, in Italy? That one soccer match that was like ground zero for the outbreak there.
Absolutely.
There was Albany, Georgia. You know, it's a relatively small town, about 75,000 people in Georgia. But the nexus there was a funeral.
Yes.
Like, it went from one funeral to another wedding or funeral, something like that. Like, everybody was degrees of separation to create this outbreak around this town. And the Wall Street Journal this week just had a fascinating report that what may have really saved San Francisco was losing that Super Bowl.
Yes.
Because the first cases have been reported right around the Super Bowl. The University of California, the San Francisco's, they built their corona unit. And the day after the Super Bowl, they took in their first two patients. And they're saying that if they had had a parade and you had hundreds of thousands of people together in that space, that we would have had something far worse than we're discussing right now. Now, are these governors really willing to put, really to go out there and take the risk of being the person that is behind something like that? It's hard for me to believe, man.
We have kind of gotten used to the idea that numbers are going to be. I've been kind of surprised at the ease with which we've accepted the idea that 30,000 people are just dead. You know what I mean? 30,000 people are dead. And I wonder if because of that, because we've sort of, eventually you get used to things. Eventually you get used to whatever the normal is. And I don't know if a governor, but I don't know if a governor would be willing to have that on their head. But I think that there's also a lot of ways to deflect and a lot of ways to say, well, that you can't say that that was on me necessarily or blah, blah. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the fan free option is there, right? Mm-hmm. That you can do this without the fans being present. And I keep hearing all these people talk about the possibility. But again, like I say, there is no way to do a football game with social distancing. It's not possible.
Yeah, no. Right.
Right. No matter who's there. We have Michael
Collins
on last.
Unless Marshall, basically.
Right, right. Yeah, you know, like we had Michael Collins on last week. He's talking about golf. And he's like, how are we supposed to televise this event with social distancing? It's not possible. Like, you got to have the crews. You got to have all these people. You got to have all these things that are necessary to take place. And I just don't see how it's happening. So to me, I find the idea that there will be sports in 2020 highly, highly, highly unlikely.
I agree, but also I'm interested in the idea that these guys are not going to forever be able to tell people we can't open back up. Again, this is going to be a trick. The thing is that we live in a, not a bubble, but we live in a world in which the sensible thing is to stay home, wash your hands, be careful. But there are a whole bunch of other people out there that ain't believing in that right now.
Yo.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, even within my own family, people that are like, yo, man, saw this 5G thing. You know, that's crazy, right? Or just, you know, I'm like, where'd you get that information from? Somebody, I was talking to one of my homeboys, and he's like, yeah, man, so I know that, like, you know, they probably invented this in a lab. That's what I heard. And I'm like, come on, man. I mean, I guess I can understand why you believe that, but, I mean, you've got access to all the same news outlets that I do. Where'd that come from, you know?
I don't know where the 5G came from. Like, who's the person that sits around? Like, how does something like that build steam?
Right.
Right, right. Like who is patient zero on the 5G conspiracy? And how does it get to enough places and enough people that it trips over to where me and you can find out about it? Because that's the question, right? Like, it can stay in a circle of people who have no credibility. Who is the bridge between those people and us that makes it such that we have some understanding that this exists?
Man, all I'll say is that Instagram has been great at spreading that bad information. I feel like I follow a lot of rappers on IG, and I would say
they're the problem.
30%. So at least, and I'm probably undercounting, a good 25%. I don't want to say nobody's names. I don't want no problems. But I'm just saying, there's a lot of dudes in the hip-hop community, man. And I mean, maybe, you know, if you went back 20, 25 years, these dudes would have been in the 5% of stuff, you know what I'm saying? So they believe in conspiracies. And I understand why a lot of black people believe in conspiracies. But this one just does not, it just doesn't add up. You know what I mean?
The one thing I will say about rappers, though, and like entertainment types, they are privy to a lot of information about things that we are not, right? Mm-hmm. Their whole world is there's the real story, and then there's what winds up coming out there. Mm-hmm. Like, I think a lot of the skepticism that you get from that class of people is because of the level of dishonesty in information in the world that they live in, that it's hard for them to believe that anything is just the way that somebody says it was.
They're not a believers in Occam's razor then, huh?
Right, 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 right. And then the other part is a whole lot of self-education that is going on. A lot of books with no barcodes, as I like to refer to them. A lot of that is happening. Poorly proofread copy, you know, like it's a lot of that goes on out here in these streets.
ISIS papers.
Also,
huh?
Oh man, I heard Cassie Collins stay trying to get us on the ISIS papers. Yo, you need to read the ISIS papers. Maybe this is a little arrogance of college me, but this is the truth. I was way more like intellectually worldly and exposed than most of the people of my age at the time, because my parents were college professors. Yeah. So like I had access to things that people did not have. And I found myself being wildly skeptical of anybody I went to college with trying to put me onto some book.
Oh man.
Cause I was like,
I got the books.
How you know? Like, I ain't heard of this. I ain't never heard my daddy talk about this, right?
Right.
Like, how you up on this game and we not? And it was always the ISIS papers, 48 laws of power.
Oh my God. Yeah.
You know, then somebody would hit you with something that, like, I didn't even know about at the time because I'm not religious. So, like, the idea of, like, anti-Semitism didn't register with me because I didn't know any Jews to be anti-Semitic toward, nor did I have any idea that the Jews may or may not have killed my Messiah. Like, none of these things, like, come up in my life. But you'd have somebody try to hit you with, like, the protocols of the elders of Zion. Like, No, my brother. I will not be participating in this.
But we talked about this before. I mean, you know, in the early 90s, for people that were not alive then or not aware of it, there was sort of a resurgence of the Nation of Islam.
The Malcolm X movie, it just came out.
Malcolm X movie, and I was right there. You know what I'm saying? And I went, I guess I'll admit this, with the understanding that I know better now. Louis Farrakhan came to Texas Southern University, I think in 93 or 94, and my father took me to go see him. And so I was hyped on all that. And it wasn't until maybe 10 years ago that, like, I actually grappled with the idea that Louis Farrakhan was anti-Semitic. Cause, like, I had not, and we've talked about this before, I did not know very many Jewish people. I had not even, you could have not even given me any clues to the things that he was saying that were anti-Semitic. It just would have totally went over my head. I would have not recognized it for what it was. And I would not argue that he is not anti-Semitic today. I think he is. But I just had no, we grew up in Texas where there just was not
Who are these Jews that you speak of?
Right.
I knew two.
Right.
Literally two. And I don't know one of their last names.
Well, somebody told me, because, you know, my thing for many years was that Shel Silverstein, I thought he was black. And they were like, Silverstein? You didn't get that that's Jewish? I was like,
no.
How in the hell was I supposed to know that was a Jewish name?
Yo, how old were you before you realized that, like, Seinfeld?
Oh,
how many of these jokes are like at the Jewish cookout jokes?
Yeah.
I had no idea. I didn't know Seinfeld was it. None of it. I had nothing.
None. I remember sort of the Shiksa episode where, like, Elaine was sort of like attractive to dudes because she, Jewish guys, because she wasn't Jewish and all like that. And that was like the first time I was like, oh, okay. Like, all these people here are Jewish, right? Okay. I get it now. Whatever. But like,
oh, so she wasn't Jewish. Oh, learn something new every day.
Is that right? Yeah, I think that's right. Somebody's going to tell us we were wrong. But there was an episode where either she was attractive to Jewish guys because she wasn't Jewish or something like that. They called her a shiksa. I remember that. That's all I remember.
Dog, I just thought that was all New York stuff. Like, I didn't know. And by the way, New York in the South, very often, code word for Jews. I just had no idea because I don't know anything about Jews.
Yeah, right. Not at all. I mean, I can't imagine you would have met many out in Waller. You know what I mean?
No. But even just in the part of town that I grew up in, not really. Like, now when you start talking about like Bel Air, like South, like there are areas of Houston where there are Jewish people. I just did not know them.
No, but Monty, like, I didn't know that Meyer Park or Meyer Land was like, that was an area where Jewish people live. Like Meyer. Meyer is supposedly like a Jewish thing. I had no idea.
Nobody told us.
The Jewish Community Center is over there too, by the way. You know,
it's like Chris Rock said, yo, we don't bring white people into little groups.
Right. Right. That was just a neighborhood that I didn't know no black people that lived in.
Right. Right. And by the way, if the rubber meets the road and it's going down, the white coalition is not going to let faith get in the way. Right?
They like in the
ways that matter to us.
Right.
There really is no reason to be breaking this down into little groups.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I was just like, hey, man, I just thought it was white people with a different religion. That was it.
I didn't know. I put my ignorance on this. I tell you this, too. There's somebody that's going to be listening to this nervous as hell about what direction this is going to go in, boy. Because, look, I ever tell you this story. It's one of my favorite stories ever. So, I was doing Dan's radio show in Miami, and there's a cat named Ethan Skolnick who worked at the radio station, and they would call him Ethan Juice Skolnick, right? What? And I heard that, and I was like, wait, what? Like, what are y'all doing down there? Right? Like, this doesn't. And so we were on the air one day and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and ask this. And I'm like, apparently, like, y'all get down differently here than I thought y'all did. Like, I don't understand it. Like, I've been listening and y'all call Ethan Skull. Like, y'all just call him Jew. Like, I don't get it. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, I mean, I just turn on the radio right. And y'all say Ethan Juice Skolnick. And they were like, no, Juice. Oh. Ethan Juice Skolnick. And I'm like, well, look, man, y'all need to start. Y'all need to talk slower.
Y'all
right?
Need to
y'all
need to, that.
Yeah. Yeah, y'all need to put a pause in between Juice and Skolnick. And everybody was so nervous as it was going on. And I'm looking at him. I'm like, y'all nervous? How you think I felt?
Oh,
right?
My God. Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm like, y'all the ones that been out here calling this man Jew. I'm like, I'm glad we could get this straight.
Right.
I'm glad that we could clarify this. Now we understand. I thought it was something that sounded crazy. It turns out that would have been crazy.
Right.
But that isn't what y'all were doing. We're all safe.
Right.
Boom. Like, we're good. But, man, they chest was...
Oh,
right there.
They were hot. Yeah, man, look, man. I mean,
they thought I was going to get everybody fired.
And see, the thing is, I thought you're the hero in that situation. Like, wait a minute. I think what's going on here is improper.
Yes.
This makes me uncomfortable. And I would like somebody to explain why you all think this is appropriate behavior.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
I'm on the right team.
Right. Right. You didn't do anything wrong as far as I'm concerned.
No. They was cool, yeah. But just the mere mention, right? Like nobody wanted those problems. And I was just trying to make it clear. I don't want these problems either.
Absolutely. And I was like, I need to know what kind of office I'm coming into. What sort of work environment? Like, what do y'all call people for real? Like, what
right,
kind
right,
of
right, right. And plus, please understand, I know that just cause y'all could do it don't mean I can do it.
Oh,
I'm just blown away by the fact that y'all could do this.
But that's exactly the approach you take. Just because y'all could do it doesn't mean that I can.
I know
do
better.
It. It's a
I know better.
And it's a rule that a lot of other people would do well to embrace.
But they don't have to.
But we don't have to.
But they don't have to. You see that clip has been going around. I guess it's that Delroy Lindo show. Where somebody
yes.
talking about why can't I say the N word? He had the his approach is the one I've been saying for years. Go ahead,
do it, say it.
Let me know how it works out. You see that? You saw that kid, the NASCAR kid that got caught saying it.
Yeah, man. Yes. Yeah, man.
Here's what gets me about this right fast, right? Because you know he got fired by his racing team. Mm-hmm. This is a quote that Chip Ganassi gave to the Associated Press. This is the team owner. I told Kyle he could come back from this. He could even come back from this with our team, but there really wasn't any choice. Why are you so concerned with telling him that he could come back?
Yeah, right.
And this is the thing on a situation like this, because as much as we have, you know, determined that the N-word is the most damning word in society, the reality is, man, you ain't gonna find too many white folks who have not said it at some point. And I'm not saying that with like a crazy judgment, because we treat it like you say N-word equals you are racist. White people are typically going to do everything they can to let you know this doesn't necessarily mean that you are a bad person, because calling him a bad person might mean calling myself a bad person. And so the message that ultimately gets sent in these times is not how bad it is, but it's maybe bad, but that doesn't mean that you're bad.
Right.
And so when this Larson dude, whenever he returns, it's going to be a standing ovation.
Oh.
How many times have we seen that?
Oh, I mean, isn't that the John Rocker?
John Rocker is that kid, the hater dude. Remember who got exposed during the All-Star game for the old tweets?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Standing ovation when he came back.
Yeah, man.
Like, if you get caught like this, somebody going to give you a standing ovation to let you know that they still got your back.
I mean, they treat these people like they came back from like a lymphoma scare or something.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, no, you did that. Like, that's something like this is an obstacle of your own making. You don't have to say it, you know?
Yep. But you know what seemed to be extra whack about that to me? So this kid is half Japanese. I keep calling him a kid. He's 27 years old, but I'm old now.
That's
so,
a kid.
You know,
I would call it 27-year-old
yeah,
kid.
Yeah. I'm at that age now where I start talking about these things differently. But he's like 27 years old. His mother, I believe, is Japanese. His grandparents were in like the internment camps and all this. He's from California. And he has said that as he's gotten older, that he kind of needs to embrace his Japanese side more. Like, he has basically ignored that for a significant portion of his life. And I read that and I could.
Wow.
Yeah. Right. Like I read that as, at least from like around Sacramento. You know what I mean? So we're not like, I can see how this will happen. But I read it as he has tried his best to fit in with the white kids.
Yeah.
Like he has tried his best to get along with them. And I wonder if he thought that what part of fitting in with the white kids was is saying the N-word. You know, because like the way he said it and like the way, and by the way, the people he said it to, they immediately were like, yo, we're not participating in this with you, right? Like none of them like met him halfway on that. Why? Because your man was over there being extra, because the dude that's trying too hard to fit in is always the dude that's out here doing something extra. And I'd be curious to know, like, if you were to get in his heart of hearts about why he did that or how he got to that place. Is it about him having like an actual hatred of black people, or is that him thinking that this is how you fit in?
Well, and I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, there's probably a lot of reasons for him to believe that that is a way yep. that you fit in, right? Or that is just the language you use, you know, around yep. each other, you know? And it may not have anything to do with actually literally hating black people. You know, you may, whatever. I mean, I'm not going to ascribe any motives to him or, you know, whatever his politics are or whatever, but at least using that sort of language, I like you said, I'm never surprised at something like this. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's not a white person alive that if you told me they said, I'd be like, oh, okay. I'm shocked. Like, I just did not see that coming. You know?
No, but like I said the same thing about men calling women. White folks are born into this madness also, right? Like you have to have a conscious effort to fight it off. Like you got you're not just going to build up with like a natural immunity to racism in America. That's not how it works. Like you got to make a conscious thing in your head. I'm not going to be this person. This is not something I'm going to do. Right. And if you think that you could just be like, oh, I'm good. I'm just going to skate by on it. Nah, man, that's probably not going to do it. So like for me, I'm with you. It's like, you're not going to shock me. And by the way, you tell me that you did this one time, like you tell me you did it last week, we might be talking about something different. But when they start going and getting people's like high school tweets and stuff like that, I'm like, dude, come on, man. We ain't even playing fair right now.
Yeah. The high school stuff is never that compelling. I mean, the thing is though, it does suck because there are black high school kids that have to go through that. They have to live alongside and go to school alongside those kids that think that that's okay or that's a way to fit in. And I mean, what did they say like in the last 3 to 4 years, like incidences of bullying and, you know, racial taunting and so on and so forth at schools are up. Because that's become part of the national language right now, right? But
but you know what I don't hear about that worries me in them cases? I don't hear about no increase in fights. Like that's my one thing. I am here for all our anti-bullying stuff that we're doing that's making the world better. But I always thought that the greatest anti-bullying mechanism that they came up with was Taekwondo studios, right? How many Taekwondo studios were kept open by bullies? Right. How many of them paid their bills or parents being like, nah, we got a solution?
So much for that. We are not our grandparents, because our grandparents fought on that kind of shit. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yes.
You know, I think every black family has somebody, has a story of a relative who beat somebody ass for being called a or being mistreated public. Yes.
Yeah. Or has their own.
Yeah.
like, this is one thing about it. The solution or what do you do if somebody calls you an N-word in my house? I'll just tell you what it wasn't. It wasn't go get the teacher. that was not how that flow chart went.
So when Monty come home, it's like, well, what did you do?
The thing is, honestly, it never even came down to what did you do? Because the conversation started with, got into a fight at school today. Like, why did you get into a fight? Well, buddy, you should mention that. Oh, okay.
Makes sense to me. Yeah.
Yep. That was all it was. That's anti-bullying in the Jones house.
Right.
The solution is to fight. But we don't do that no more.
They make fights so much more serious at school too. Like you get arrested.
Yeah, I would say that started when we was in school when they started like putting people in jail behind a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they really try to put a cut in that. I went to public school public high school for a year, you know, because I ended up in straight. And I mean, they had fights in cafeteria all the time. That was the only time you could get at people. You know what I'm saying? That or after school. And there'd be fights all the time, and people just go right back to class. you know. But it was like not long after that is when they started putting people. I guess they started criminalizing people. That was just part of the what we thought was acceptable to do to children back then. And I guess we still sort of do. We have cops in school. There's no reason for cops to be in school unless they're gonna be in there arresting people, right? So
yeah. By the way, before we go, it's kind of got to suck if, like, this is your year to be drafted, right?
Oh, man.
Ain't no draft party for you?
Bro.
You just around your parents the whole time?
I mean, you'll get drafted. You might not even know if you're going to play. You're not going to meet your teammates. When is that going to happen? You're not going to get to do the jersey, the hold up your jersey thing. You know what I'm saying? At the press conference. It's just,
you don't get to dap Raj up.
Man. It's just going to be... That part's really deflating. I mean, we also think about this too, man. You know, I think so much of the NFL draft process is this ridiculousness that a lot of it is unnecessary. And I remember reading a story on Jordan Love, a profile, and in the story they talk about how in one of the combine interviews, one of the coaches asked a prospect, "What would you do if I were to punch you right now?" And I'm like, what is that telling you about anything related to, you know, how somebody's going to play football, kind of employee they're going to be. So that part of it has been good in that way. But I also, you mentioned HBCUs and the effect this is taking on them. And I think about guys from the smaller schools and HBCUs and like guys that would be, you know, low round draft picks and but are free agents. Like they're really going to be hurt as a result of this sort of stuff because they don't have a chance to go out and impress people or get workouts in or, man, that part of it, like that class of NFL draft prospects who are not first round, second round picks, like it is really, really going to hurt them. And I kind of wonder what's going to happen with that.
Yeah. By the way, the answer to what would you do if I punch you right now is only one way to find out. Right? That's the only answer.
Right. Well, I also thought I was like, well, you're not going to do that though. So.
Right. But yeah, right. But you're not. That's the answer, but you're not.
But you're not, right.
But what if I did, but you're not?
But it's not going to happen, so. <Next
question. laughs> Come on, now. You're not crazy, and you don't know if I am. Did you have, like, a certified, like, oh, my God, he's crazy on the football team when you was at TCU? You ain't got to name him.
Oh, man. Well, yeah, okay. What, man, shot, yeah. That dude, first of all, he had the biggest, loudest stereo system in the dorm and basically dared you to make him turn his music off. He was that guy. And I'm not going to say his name. So one night, I was one of the few people that had a car on campus because I was always going home. And, I mean, it was an 87 Honda Civic CRX. So I don't want people to think I had like money. It was a little hatchback. But anyway, I had to go up. I went to go to Best Buy to buy like some music. So, this dude came with me. We came back and I don't know what I was doing. I didn't lock my car door. And he was like, hey man, you might want to lock that. I was like, okay. It was just kind of weird that he said it. Within a year, he had been kicked out of school for stealing out of people's cars on campus. So, yeah, man. He was a wild boy, man. I mean, the thing is, there's a lot of crazy dudes on a football. You know what I mean? There's a lot of crazy dudes, but like, he was notably, it's not like he was the biggest dude. He was like 6 foot 230, you know what I'm saying? But he was just brolic. Like, nobody would ever challenge that dude.
Yes. Well, my favorite guys on the football team are the ones that are hood as they want to be, but somehow figure out how to navigate through that university system while being every bit as hood as we are describing, right? Like somehow they figure out how to make it work without having to change a thing. And I don't mean they just figured out how to make it work just because they like went to play ball at the school. No, I mean that they navigated the social infrastructure. They partners was coming up and now all of a sudden they are also now fixtures of the community.
Oh yeah. I mean, man, dog. Yeah. Those guys that stick around, the guys are like, let me give you some game. You know, I mean, one dude told me, you will be drinking by the end of this year. He's like, I don't care what your beliefs are or what it is, you will be drinking by the end of this year, young buck. And that dude told me that. And I was like, what? And he's like, nah, man, trust me. And, it's just, you know, yeah, guys like that, man, you know, that are not, you know, that you can trust them, because you want people that are not, you know, not necessarily like coaches' pets or whatever, people right. that are going to give you the real about like what the system is and how to like, man, I mean, there was a deal where, you know, people were selling their books back, you know, which is, you can go to jail for that. You can go to prison for that.
It's crazy. And you actually can.
Yeah. Right. And they were doing it, and I didn't know that was something that was against the law, but it was a very common thing back then. Or stealing from the cafeteria. There's somebody, one of my dudes taught me how to steal from the cafeteria. And I'll never forget. I went to lunch with him, and I'll just call him Johnny because nobody, I mean, who could figure that? So I was like, and so Johnny's getting his tray, and he walks out the back way. And I'm like, Johnny, cash register over here. And he's like, shh, what are you doing? And he got me. And I was like, oh, okay, that's how it works. So, I mean, by the end of the year, I had a napkin dispenser. You know, I went Woo! In there. I had, you know, utensils, all that.
Oh, yeah,
stuff,
I had all know? That. Yeah. Undergrad, man, I was getting all that. I was getting all that stuff out of the cafeteria. Another school I went to, I was broke. Like, it was hard times at this school. I'm a little ashamed of all the boosting and everything else. Like the ways that we strong-armed our way in, the back doors we snuck in, or the times that we was just like, I'm going to just put my head down and just keep on walking. Like, I'm going to just put my head down and act like I'm supposed to be here.
I think it gives you character to steal like that in college, man. I think it gives you some character. You know, you got to risk some things, you know, to gain some things.
It tests your nerve.
Yeah, it does.
It tests your nerve. But hey, man, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Joel Anderson, check him out, slate.com. I don't know how we're going to describe what we talked about, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was good times, man. Thanks for having me on. We've taken up some quarantine time. All right.
Hey, man, I'm here for you. I appreciate it. And remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to think you are a hater, and we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.